Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Pod Shotcast. Pod Shotcast.
That's what we should call it.
Podcast.
Shotcast. That's it.
And I even have one of my coffee, and Dave has poured half of his over his laptop. So we're off to a good start this morning. My name is Jo Dyer, and I am here as ever with Dave Milner.
Hello, Jo.
And with Grace Tame.
G'day.
And Charles Firth is away writing, so we get to play up in his absence and generally diss him.
The boss isn't here. This is good.
Yeah. So it's been quite a week, as ever. People have described Albo as having, you know, the very bad, terrible, no good weekend from hell, with the gloss coming off him, as ever. Kind of Murdoch is back in the press, and we're leading up to the coronation of our new monarch and our new head of state next week. So, Grace, what are you looking forward to King Charles III officially becoming our head of state?
Is that a rhetorical question, Joe?
If you heard that noise before, that was Grace dry reaching.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of, we've had this sort of weird interregnum period where he's been the king, but he hasn't had the crown officially placed upon his head. And there's been all sorts of rumours about what's going to be taking place. But we were told that there's going to be a call and response where we get to actually pledge our allegiance along in the same moment, in real time, with all of the other subjects from the Commonwealth around the world.
Oh,
too
God.
Exciting.
Look. Oh, God, can you just imagine some of those homes in, you know, Brighton and Toorak and some of those living rooms, my God, that's a sad
Tim
sight.
Tim Smith
to
style, yeah. Being obsequious.
Tim Smith will definitely do that on Saturday. I think we all need
he
to
will.
Process that.
He will kind of cosplay the subject.
Grace, are you going to be pledging allegiance to the king?
Look, I'll pledge allegiance to the castle, but I don't know.
The film?
Yes.
No, that's fair.
The vibe of the thing.
As an advocate for child protection and for the rights of fellow survivors of child sexual abuse, for fellow men and women like myself, I think it's important to remember that the opposite of love and adoration, admiration, is not actually hate, it's indifference. So I won't be personally swearing anything. I won't even be swearing under my breath, literally. There are many reasons to renounce the soft rule, if you will, of the British monarchy and call for Australian independence and become a republic. If you want to just look at their track record of colonial invasions and genocide and the transatlantic slave trade and racism.
Which The Guardian has done a very good job of actually bringing out and articulating,
yes,
all of the kind of historical links to the slave trade. That sort of level of detail I hadn't seen before and wasn't fully aware
all of. All of those things that I just listed are well documented from a myriad of sources, not just one. Personally, though, if we want to just zone in on one issue, and this perhaps has been strategically covered up, child sexual abuse and the royal family's links to it. And I'm not just talking about Prince Andrew. I'm talking about people like Jimmy Savile, Rolf Harris, Lord Mountbatten, who is the late great uncle of Charles III.
And very favourite uncle.
Well, so Charles was the protege of Mountbatten.
I only know this because I've watched much of The Crown. I do think I know who you're talking about.
And that is a very strange narrative of Lord Mountbatten. That's very whitewashed.
Sure.
You know, I have no doubt that's true, but it is like, is it the guy from Game of Thrones? Charles Dance? gets the like the creepy vibes across.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very fine actor, Charles Dance.
So obviously. Have either of you heard of Kincora Boys Home?
Yes, I have, but only relatively recently. Yes, only in the last sort of 12 to 18 months, actually.
Because I was talking to you.
Because I told you about it. Well,
so, Grace, why don't you tell me about it again?
Explain, because it is a shocking tale.
Yeah, for listeners who are unfamiliar with Kincora Boys Home, it was established in 1958 in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and supposedly it was a residential care facility for vulnerable, homeless, orphaned young boys. And one of the housemasters was a man named William McGrath. He was a Northern Ireland loyalist, an evangelical Protestant priest, and a known homosexual. So the other two main housemasters were Joseph Maines and Raymond Stemple. It was later discovered after a number of army intelligence officers, two main army intelligence officers, made reports to local police after allegations of abuse at the home were made, and the reports were quashed. They didn't go anywhere. And interestingly, one of these army intelligence officers, specifically this guy was, his name was Colin Wallace, was framed for manslaughter and served 6 years in prison. And then in 1990, the Thatcher government had to apologise to both the UK Parliament and to the public for his wrongful incarceration. The home actually closed down in 1980. The three housemasters that I listed, William McGrath, Joseph Maines, and Raymond Stemple, were all jailed for sexually abusing 11 of the boys. There was an investigation conducted in recent years, the Historical Institutional Abuse Inquiry, and that found that at least 39 boys over the period of its you know, being open were abused. And the main headmaster, this guy William McGrath, was suspected to be an MI5 informant. And while this it looked like the stuff of conspiracy, in the time that it was open, a number of politicians visited, and there were all these cover-ups and attempts to just quash investigations. And then in October last year, a man named Arthur Smythe, he waived his anonymity in the process of launching several lawsuits against a number of institutions. And he identified Lord Mountbatten as the man he alleges abused him twice at Kincora.
So what's the status of that? Is there any kind of, is he suing? What is the status of his allegations now against Lord Mountbatten?
Well, Lord Mountbatten is dead. I mean, he died in 1979. The story goes that the IRA blew up the boat that he was on.
Yeah.
The lawsuits are against a number of institutions. He's suing for damages. Those are, as I understand it, still ongoing, those lawsuits.
So are there any allegations that this was known at the time? I mean, do we know anything about how widely known?
Yes, as I said, so we've got Brian Gemmell as another army intelligence officer who made a report to police. He was trying to blow the whistle, and his experience was his attempts to seek justice were blocked. He was quoted as saying, actually, when the BBC interviewed him in recent years, that we were essentially that there were people at the highest level involved in this operation. When this Historical Institutional Abuse Inquiry, the HIA as its acronym, when that was conducted, there were several Kincora survivors who spoke out in around 2016 who expressed their hope One of them, Clint Massey, said, you know, there was a cover-up, there was state collusion in what was going on at Kincora. It should have been stopped. There were people that wanted to stop it and they were blocked. What happened was they looked into, as often these inquiries and commissions and reports do, they looked into the abuse itself and the perpetrators themselves, but not into the collusion or suspected collusion and corruption at the higher levels within the bodies beyond the actual location. And that's what's I personally find is really interesting. You have to really look further. And, and there was actually a book that came out in 2019, according to the Irish Times. And when they reported it, they didn't mention the name of the book, but they've got another two boys. They're both Sri Lankan, both de-identified. And they reported also being abused by Mountbatten. They reported being driven from Kincora to hotels and being abused by Mountbatten, but only identifying Mountbatten after seeing his death reported on the television.
And what, recognizing pictures of him?
Yeah, recognizing pictures of him and footage of him on the television after he died. But it's quite interesting because the name of that book wasn't mentioned. However, I know that there is a book that is specifically about the Kincora scandal, written by an award-winning Irish journalist called Chris Moore. You can't get access to it in Australia, which, again, very interesting. All of this stuff
is it available in the UK and Ireland?
It's available in the UK and Ireland. Another piece of the puzzle is that the HIA, this investigation that was conducted in recent years, it agreed that there'd been all this egregious abuse. You know, there'd been suicides from some of the boys in the 70s, but it said that there wasn't any state collusion. But then it also found that most of the documents, if not all of the documents, had been destroyed, which is often a big clue.
And on what basis did it say there had been no state collusion? Did it actually actively investigate that and come to some conclusion?
No, because
that's all a very unclear.
So the HIA was not the only investigation, as far as I understand it, and every investigation has had a very limited remit.
So the terms of reference are deliberately set up such that investigations into those sort of murkier areas and into the upper echelons of British society and power are left. Yeah.
You're saying these royals are kind of shifty?
Well, I think the royals are kind of shifty, and that's what's kind of been interesting. So I think this area in particular, because, you know, there was almost a canonisation of Mountbatten that happened, being the favoured uncle of Charles and someone who had been alleged to have, you know, really acted as a father figure, given the distant kind of cold parents that he apparently had. So he was really, you know, in the popular mythology, was an important figure in the royal family and certainly in the life of Queen Elizabeth and particularly now King Charles. And so to learn that he was potentially engaged and allegedly engaged in criminal activity that destroyed the lives of many young children, you know, I mean, it seems extraordinary that there hasn't been further investigation into this, but there does seem to still be in Britain this kind of the haloed effect of the upper echelons of the aristocracy. And we're seeing some of that now play out because Prince Harry is now just throwing truth bombs everywhere because he doesn't care anymore. And he's decided that actually people are more important than institutions.
He's out.
He chose love, and not just love of social media. We're kind of seeing some of the deals that were done behind the scenes between the royal family as an institution and the media, so that some of those scandals that around the time of the phone hacking scandals didn't come into the public eye, and they've just basically accepted money to keep things out of the press. So that kind of collusion is clearly, you know, still there.
Yeah.
And these are the people who apparently, UK, who are head of state.
The way the royal correspondent ring works is remarkable. It's basically you employ, you know, newspapers have their own royal correspondent, and that doesn't mean anything other than these people get drip-fed exactly what they should say directly from the press officer inside the royal family. This is not a, you know, mark of prestige. This means you are
the stooge
of these institutions. If ever you see royal correspondents, stop listening to
that person. What's interesting about Kincora to me is it's sort of it's the chicken or the egg factor. We had, you know, when you look at a character like William McGrath, it's hard because I'm coming at this from, I'm always trying to externalize all this internal knowledge and explain to people in the right order. But, you know, he was a known pedophile. And so you've got a situation where there was a pedophile ring there. You know, when you've got such allegedly active suppression of information, was it that there was a pedophile ring going on and, you know, the state or, you know, security services got wind of it and saw a purpose for it? Or was it orchestrated from the very, very beginning if William McGrath himself was indeed, you know, as I understand it, yes, he was an MI5 agent. So, you know, was it that it functioned as both a brothel? This is my understanding. This is my interpretation. You know, I allege that, you know, that it functioned as both a brothel and as part of a honey trap for acquiring blackmail. And this was quite common during the Cold War. Like, we're looking at 1958 to 1980. This is the Cold War era. This is not just, you know, in Ireland where tensions were high between the Protestants and the Catholics, you know, and William McGrath being a Protestant extremist evangelist, you know. So you've got the boys being exploited literally as human bait, and staff and visiting politicians as well, and paramilitaries, you know, given access to not only forbidden fruit, but tempted with that homosexuality, which was also such a grave offence at that time in history, and then being compromised. So it's like these offenders certainly are to blame, who directly perpetrated the offences, but then also the covert puppet masters who potentially, you know, I personally believe helped design and orchestrate.
So you're saying that there was this sort of honey trap whereby there were these young boys were used as kind of, as you say, bait for powerful people to come and perpetrate crimes against them. And then those powerful people went back to their lives and were then blackmailed to provide information or become informants in different ways, in a pervasive way throughout the upper echelons of British society.
Yes, yes. I mean, it was...
And that was a deliberate strategy that was used by MI5.
Yes, and this was not... Kincora was not the only example of this.
Yeah.
Certainly. Not during... At this time in history, this was not the only example of this. I mean, this was a dirty apparatus of biochemical warfare, and we saw this throughout these hotspots when we consider especially what the United States were up to at the time.
Well, I mean, compromat is a kind of strategy that was used by secret service organizations around the world, in, you know, different ways, whether or not it was, you know, female prostitutes, which whilst were illegal and had the potential to bring shame on people, is a kind of a different measure and not the kind of the same criminal violent act that we're talking about when we're talking about child sexual abuse and, you know, perpetrating crimes against minors in the same way. And so this then is the favourite uncle of our soon-to-be crowned King Charles. One does wonder, given that there does seem to be more information coming out about this, whether or not, I mean, whether or not this will be explored in a more prominent way, and whether or not kind of some forms of justice can be visited through civil legal proceedings which have now been launched.
Yeah, and I mean, you also got the relationship that he had, the deferential relationship that he had with or to Jimmy Savile, who was awarded a knighthood.
I mean, and throughout Jimmy Savile's kind of extraordinarily prolific criminal career, there were what is just sort of devastating to see at every turn, there were these schools, residential boarding schools for particularly vulnerable children, whether or not it was blind children or destitute orphans, or at every turn, there was this sort of smorgasbord of young children provided for these kind of criminals. And, you know, they had seeming impunity as they kind of cut this criminal sway through the country.
And let's be clear, Joe, who's providing them?
Well, this is the thing. Look, Grace would probably know more, but a lot of these schools, Savile was giving money, and thus the headmasters and headmistresses seem to take the money and then turn the blind eye. I can't speak to with Savile whether or not there was a more kind of coordinated strategy, or is that he just bought access for himself and then had these friends in very high places who also were prepared to take a blind eye. I mean, whether it was the BBC or indeed, you know, Charles was friends with Savile, and indeed Rolf Harris. Rolf Harris painted the Queen's official fucking portrait, for Christ's sake. These sort of links are everywhere, I guess.
Here's an opportunity to explain this very confusing dichotomy that people struggle with when it comes to the outward-facing presentation of a lot of very calculating, manipulative perpetrators who, when people who are, you know, even people who are close to them find out, and their initial reaction is, well, they were such a nice guy. They engage a lot of these, often very high profile, very high powered, well connected offenders engage in philanthropy, in supposed altruism, and that is a part of their cover story. And they are very charming. They are very charismatic. I was speaking to my mother yesterday, who, you know, she came from the working classes. She worked in a myriad of jobs, and she's had a very colorful life. One of the things she used to do was to practice her. She used to be really quite shy before she ended up, oddly, at a local television station, first working in just production, and then one day she interviewed to be a news anchor. But she, to get her confidence up, she used to go to the local prison down here in Tasmania and debate with the prisoners.
Oh, God.
And she would sit, I know, she would sit, not that
keep you on your toes, certainly.
She was talking to me about this yesterday. She said,
Do they let you into prison for debates?
We used to debate, and when in South Australia, like we had it, just quick diversion, the South Australian Debating Association had an adults debating championship. So when you left school, but not out, separate from the universities, and one of the most successful teams in that were a debating team of prisoners. And so the debating teams used to go in and debate prisoners. Separate, I mean, that's a slightly different thing because that was an organised competition in which they participated.
Yeah, and Mum was saying that she would, you know, she would spend time with these people, not just during the process of the debates themselves. She would interact with them afterwards in the cafeteria. She would receive feedback from some of them. She said she was speaking to one man who was giving her advice afterwards and encouragement, and he said he was really kind, and he said, oh, you've really got to keep it up. It was really lovely. And she said, well, you know, but this guy was in there for, you know, like a double murder. And she said, look, if I can be confused by this, you know, by this man's kindness and generosity and just willingness to connect, she said, you feel that connection. There's just a human being there.
Well, I think one of the things that was sort of devastating to learn this week, and then you ask yourself why you're so surprised, was there was more information came out about Jeffrey Epstein's extraordinary networks, and progressives all around the world's kind of hearts broke a little when we learned that Noam Chomsky had also had a number of meetings, like many meetings, with Epstein. And this was after he had served his, you know, almost home detention that he did. So he was a convicted child sex abuser. And that's to your point, Grace, about the way that philanthropy was used. He was an incredibly wealthy man, and he deployed his wealth to disguise what he was doing. And whilst he lined up the other men who he then presumably by careful conversation, investigation, worked out who were interested in joining him in his pedophile ring. But yeah, Noam Chomsky was apparently had a number of meetings with him, which was about trying to get money, again, like the headmasters and headmistresses of these schools of the vulnerable in the UK, trying to get money for their institutions.
They are masters of it. I shit you not. Look, it is really important to point out. So when we're talking about child sexual abuse, I want to make this point really clearly. There are children who are abused by adults, recidivist adults who are, you know, and I don't use this term lightly, who are psychopathic. And those children who have been abused, who've been told by these, thankfully, very few and far between types, these children don't know that what has happened to them is wrong because they are children. And by virtue of the experience of childhood, which is the process of integrating, they then perhaps perpetrate abuse because they've been sexualized and corrupted. They perpetrate abuse because they think that that is a loving thing to do, because during the grooming and offending, they've been told that they are being subjected to a loving experience. Now, these children who perpetrate abuse are in a different category. There is more hope of redeeming these children. And, you know, we should give these children at this point in their development treatment and support instead of punishment and shame. The recidivist, much, much older, calculating, psychopathic, sadistic abuser who may actually claim themselves that they have been a victim of abuse, and there are ways to tell that they haven't, because when somebody is disclosing, usually it's an uninterruptible thing where you can see that they're going into a state of a flashback. You know, like that's a different kind of an abuser. Mm. And we really need to have this distinction made.
Yeah.
Because these types of offenders are so good at crafting an outward-facing narrative and an outward-facing character that is remarkable at galvanizing sympathy, and the sympathy that they pull draws the sympathy away from the legitimate victims, including those younger children who may themselves have been abused. And in the cases where they themselves act out, are not actually understanding what they've done. And then we see those children criminalized, get stuck in the system, and it's all just flipped on its head. I don't know. That's just my TED talk for the day.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is what we've learned about today is not those children that warrant our sympathy and are potentially can be helped through treatment. Is we're talking about powerful or rings of powerful people who are using their privilege to perpetrate crimes. And now we're talking about our head of state having been related to one of them, and indeed view him as an important father figure in his life. Not to mention Andrew, indeed, his brother, who Charles does seem to have some sympathy for. So it's interesting, as the coronation approaches, there are both kind of institutional reasons why it is ridiculous that King Charles is our head of state. There are national, and by that I mean this notion of an aristocracy generally, that by virtue of birth, some people sit above others, which is kind of madness. Then there are national reasons. We are an independent nation. Why are we still beholden to a country on the other side of the world? And then there are very personal reasons why, the nature of the people who occupy that institution at the moment. And I think that goes to the points that you have been making today, Grace. So it's kind of bizarre. And yet here we have this sort of conga line of people from the Prime Minister down going over to, as he said, Albanese said very explicitly, he will be pledging allegiance to King Charles on Saturday. We've been asked to do the same if we are so inclined.
At least we didn't have to pledge allegiance to Kyle Sanderlands a few days ago.
Well, you know, the thing is that...
He's having a fucking good week, isn't he?
Like, Albo didn't have to do that either, and yet he did. And that, to me, is extraordinary. And we all know why he did. It's because Kyle is one of the DJs on the... or broadcasters on the highest rating show here in New South Wales, and that's why he did it.
Yeah, he talks to a target demographic of the dickheads in Sydney, and that's, you know, that's the voting block that Albo needs to secure. I get it politically. I understand it, but I also think, you know, in the same week where you come out and tell the nation that you're acknowledging explicitly the job seeker isn't enough to live on with dignity and decent mental health by saying it does need to increase for a tiny little cohort and we're just going to pick people above 55 and everyone else below that can just keep sucking on it. To do that in the same week that you go to Kyle Sanderland's wedding and then fly over to the UK to pledge allegiance to King fucking Charles... My God, could we have a progressive party in this country, please?
Look, it is extraordinary that they have... I mean, I don't know whether or not it was just the case of, you know, putting the flag up the flagpole and seeing what happened. I thought it was demeaning of the prime ministership to have Albo go to Carl Sandilands' wedding. Chris Minns was there as well. He apparently didn't stay as long. Albo stayed late into the night. That said, is it any more demeaning when we have the just procession of coalition politicians from the Prime Minister and the Treasurer down who go to Lachlan Murdoch's Christmas party? I don't know. Why do we make a distinction between those two people? What, because one's a bit of a bogan and a dickhead? I mean, he's more explicitly outrageous with some of the things that he's said around homosexuality, around women, around fat people, all of these things. I don't know. Is it because it's more explicit and gauche and vulgar? Possibly, because in the end, they're still just, we've got politicians being supine and obsequious to powerful media figures. But what is interesting, I think, when we have this, you know, the endless policy debate about what is and isn't going to be in the budget, which is now only, you know, a week away, this idea that you should pick off people in the way that they have. And so, you know, great that they're finally recognising the mistake that Gillard made when she took single mothers off the single parent benefit and put them on to what was then New Start. But, you know, they say, oh, so we may take it back from 8 to 12 or 14, but not back to 16 where it should be. But this job seeker thing, I mean, I just find it extraordinary that after, you know, decades where young people have been just sort of thrown to the scrap heap, discriminated against at every turn, the intergenerational discrimination that takes place in this country around wealth, at every policy turn, that even job seeker, like even people who have no wealth at all and are potentially staring homelessness down the barrel at age 55 plus, so it's not to say that women, you know, the biggest cohort of growing homelessness, we've all heard that story. It's not to say that they shouldn't have an increase in job seeker, but to recognise that for that group of people and to say to young people after everything that they suffer and continue to suffer from discrimination to mental health issues to, you know, lack of housing, to lack of job availability, to education costing, you know, just multiple times more than the boomers had to pay, many of whom had free education, to say you, it's okay for you to stay in poverty. There is no logical justification for it at all. And it's either just, you know, we'll do what we can in this sort of ridiculous piecemeal way and privilege older people because that's what we reflexively do, or it is a divide and conquer thing. It is to say, it is saying we'll split the vulnerable up. And so we'll try and get some of them to support us more. And the young people who are never going to support the coalition, well, fuck you, we'll just factor you in. And I think it's not only is it outrageous and appalling, and it immoral, but it's also, you know, politically stupid, because here we have the Greens waiting with open arms for young people to come flocking to them, this growing demographic of people. And if the Labor, you know, basically alienates and ostracizes them, then they will suffer for that at the ballot box. And so they should. And let us hope that the white hot, the incandescent rage, which came out when this sort of balloon was flown, will be enough for them to think again in the week that they have left, or the 5 days they have left before they have to send the budget to the printers.
I'd hope so. And I mean, I wrote about this last week. I wrote an article called What is the Point of Prime Minister Anthony Albanese? And, you know, largely about this sort of thing. And I got criticised quite a little bit on Twitter, A, for including sort of a youth versus older people angle. And I do get that criticism a little bit, because this is, you know, this is an eternal thing. I understand that young people always feel this way about old people. But the difference is the policies put in place right now are just exacerbating it to such a ridiculous degree.
I think the stats are in. I mean, just, I think that's just, to that point.
Yeah, we have the data on this. Look at Greg's work from The Guardian. He's been really good on this subject. It's just all there. And so there does need to be some teeth and some pushback. The other thing I got criticized for, which I just thought was remarkable, was people were like, did you go after Scott Morrison as hard as this?
Have they met our friend Dave Milner?
I tweeted last night, like, slightly incandescent with rage. Motherfucker, I made an art form of criticizing Scott Morrison.
You came to prominence on your criticism of Scott Morrison, and we loved you for that. But, you know, this is, and look, and there are obviously a group of rusted-on Labor supporters, and in my past I would have been one of them, who don't think we should be criticising the Labor Party whilst they're still in their first term, or if at all. Then there's another group who are still so relieved that we no longer have Scott Morrison that they don't want people to go too hard on this government, because thank Christ it's not.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a shush, 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 you'll wreck it kind of thing. This is going to pop if you don't say these things. And that's just not
no,
how it
and
works.
I also do think, and this point was being made a little by Amy Remikus on Insiders this week, is that everybody seems to still think that we, you know, we are a. There isn't an acknowledgement, actually, that a lot of the Australian public did vote for real change. They didn't just vote to have a more likeable Prime Minister at the helm. They actually wanted to see real action on climate change, and they want to have a more socially just and inclusive Australia.
And this is a huge thing behind the teal push. And I know that they do get called green, you know, greener libs kind of thing, and that is, you know, perhaps that's a fair criticism of a lot of them, but I think that negates the main point, that what these people actually are is free of party discipline, free of party caucus. So many, like all the most empathetic Labor backbenchers probably hate a lot of this stuff, but they're absolutely useless because they just have to vote with the party.
Although I will say that my opponent in Boothby, Louise Miller-Frost, now the member for Boothby, was one of a few backbenchers who came out and who signed the open letter from ACOS and have now been agitating from the backbench. This is a widespread view.
Absolutely. They will still vote with the party.
Well, they will still vote. But
and that's the main point of difference, I think. People see that the Teals will actually vote on their conviction on all of these issues.
That is completely true. Look, we don't know what's going to be in the budget yet. I think that there's a lot of positioning which is going on, as there always is in the lead up to it, going off to print. And as I say, let us hope that these sort of strong positions being put eloquently and emphatically around particularly assistance to the most vulnerable. There's, you know, even you've got Ken Henry coming out and saying the idea that increasing job seeker might risk inflation is just ludicrous, particularly because most inflation is coming from supply side issues or indeed inflated profits. So I think there is this sort of universal position which is being put by everybody except for the government and the opposition at the moment. So let's see. You know, I got criticised on Twitter for putting a strong position. They're saying, well, you don't know what's going to be in the budget. And I think the reality is that we do have to push back on these things. Otherwise, there's an inevitability about what's going to be in the budget.
There's a whole
so let's see.
They need to feel leftward pressure as well.
Yeah.
It is. And if they're only getting yelled at by the crazies in News Corp, then that would be the only pressure they feel to drift that way. It seems absurd that progressive people wouldn't want progressive critique of, you know, supposedly the party that's representing their interests. I do not understand that at all.
Well, next time we meet, the budget will have been handed down. The king will have been crowned. So there'll be, as ever, a lot more to talk about. Thank you, everyone out there, for listening. Thank you to Grace and to Dave. Maybe Charles will join us. I should thank our equipment people, but I can't remember who they are. So Charles will probably add that in later.
It's Rode Microphones, I think.
Oh, right, there we go.
And Acast Network.
There we go, Dave, stepping up. Thank you all. Thank you for joining us, and you'll hear from us next week.
Yay!
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.